My learning curve has been high this afternoon as I've spent some time with Randy and Denise and learning about the community, learning a lot of the history of this area, learning about the friends from Iowa, and we have folks here from Wisconsin and Minnesota, is that right? So I look forward to continuing my learning process here during the next couple of days. As Randy says, I'm here representing the kinds of places and ministries that many of you are from, though I'm hoping that even if you're not from a small church or from a small town, that there might still be some things that you'll hear from me that will be applicable to your particular context. So do you remember this commercial? A tutor sitting at a table, and he's asking the question, which is better, big or small? Do you remember the answer to the question? The answer is, well, I need some help advancing here, I guess. The answer is, it's not complicated. Big is better. Is it? Certainly it can be, right? You folks here are enjoying some sweet corn this weekend. Back in Morton, where I'm from, Morton, Illinois, we enjoy pumpkins. We call ourselves the pumpkin capital of the world, and that's because we have the Nestle's plant, the Libby's. They're a subsidiary, or Libby's is a subsidiary of Nestle's, and we plant about 90% of the world's pumpkin right there in Morton, Illinois. So combine that with the fact that we have Caterpillar, the big equipment operator, located close to us. In fact, we have the distribution center, the world distribution center for all cat products right in Morton where I live. So that means we have a lot of engineer types, and put engineers and pumpkins together, and what do you have? So we're kind of known for pumpkin chucking. Pumpkin chucking. So tonight when you go home, you can Google that. You can look at some YouTube videos and have a little bit of fun with that. We have the world Guinness World Record pumpkin chucker. I can see it from the window of my office. It has chucked a pumpkin almost a mile. So it's a pretty spectacular event, and it's kind of a lot of fun. But anyway, back to big is better. Caterpillar, the giant earth-moving company, not just a big company, but they create some big products, don't they? And I'm pretty sure that miners, coal miners, other kinds of miners would say that they would far rather have a piece of Caterpillar equipment, some of it which stands like 5 stories high. I mean, the tires of this thing are way taller than me. They'd far rather have that piece of equipment than they would have a shovel that they might find in my garage. So sometimes bigger is better, right? In my early years, I had a big is better way of thinking. Roxy and I grew up in big city of Phoenix. Our church was quite large, a couple of thousand. I'm a graduate of one of the largest seminaries in the world. Big is better, right? Well, before I go any further, I would like to make it clear that I'm not here these next couple of days to disparage big. I had a wonderful upbringing in Phoenix. Our church there had a profound impact in both my wife's and my lives, and I'm very grateful for the education that I had from my seminary. If you want me to sing the praises of Big, maybe you can invite me back for another conference and I'll do that, but I'm not going to do that here the next couple of days. The reason is I think that a dose of reality is important. For every Big ministry, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of smaller ministries. Most churches today are smaller than the mega churches that seem to get the lion's share of attention. The vast majority of pastors never in their lifetimes will serve a church that's larger than 150 people. And beyond the church, most ministries are small. In fact, if you think about it, even most ministries in big churches are small. God in His sovereignty years ago plucked Roxy and me out of Big and put us into small. Small town, small church, and 30-some years later, that's where we still find ourselves. I'm ashamed to say that I began ministry as a pastor in a small church with kind of a bit of an attitude, an air of superiority. I determined that I was going to try to turn my small church into a big church, which proved to be an exercise in futility, in part because I don't think I have the gifts that are needed for pastoring a larger church, but also in part because our entire 40-square-mile county only had 600 people in it, which was hardly an environment for a large church. Slowly, and I have to emphasize that word slowly, because I'm a little thick-headed, God has helped me with my perspective on small. Because many of you are from smaller churches, I'd like for us to think about size for these next few moments. I know of no better place to gain a healthy perspective than Zechariah chapter 4. Zechariah chapter 4. A remnant of Jews had just returned from captivity. A small percentage of the total that at one time inhabited Israel. One of the first things that these returnees did was to begin rebuilding the temple. And at first they were highly motivated because after all it had been a number of years since they had worshiped together as a gathering of believers. But then Ezra chapter 3 tells us that after the foundation for what was to be their new temple was completed, discouragement set in. And it started among the old-timers. Now imagine that all you have in front of you is a foundation. What does a foundation tell us? Nothing about what the building is going to look like, right? Nothing about how elaborate, how luxurious, how architecturally pleasing that building might be. A foundation tells us one thing. It tells us its size. Old-timers who had remembered the previous temple, Solomon's temple, looked at the footprint of what was to be the new temple, and with the assumption that big is better, concluded that their new temple would be inferior. And Ezra tells us, Ezra chapter 3, verse 12, tells us that they wept. Now these Jews were undoubtedly grieving because this smaller foundation was one more painful reminder that family and friends had been forcibly removed from them, that their community was much smaller in size than it had once been, that the huge drop in population meant that they would probably never in their lifetimes see a huge throng of worshipers filling a massive temple. This kind of sounds like the world that I minister in and that some of you minister in. 46% of all rural counties in the U.S. lost population in the last 10 years. 46%. Rural folks understand all too well the kind of grief and discouragement that these Jews in Zechariah's day were feeling in the midst of severe population decline. And naturally, one of the results was a much smaller footprint for what's supposed to be their new temple. As they looked at that footprint, probably some questions began to emerge. I don't know exactly what kind of questions they would have asked back in their day, but I can imagine what kind of questions we would ask today. Questions like, can we worship as well? Can our ministry to children and youth, can they be as effective? Does reduced size mean reduced spiritual vitality? Should we maybe lower our expectations to match our size? Sometimes we don't respond very well to questions like these, do we? In Ezra's day, the discovery that their temple would be smaller sent them into a tailspin, and for the next 15 years, the foundation just sat there. They were apparently so convinced that big is better that they concluded that no temple was better than a smaller temple. It's because of this discouragement and halted construction that we have Zechariah chapter 4. The prophet tells us of a vision that he'd received from the Lord of a completed, functioning temple. In the midst of sharing this vision, verse 7, Zechariah predicts that this completed temple will become a reality during Zerubbabel's administration. Zerubbabel was the governor at that time. Verse 7 of chapter 4, Zechariah speaking, he asks the question, "Who are you, O great mountain?" Mountain here is a metaphor for just a massive obstacle in front of us. How can we possibly get to the other side of this obstacle? The overwhelming feelings that these people were experiencing about this smaller temple was like a mountain in front of them that they couldn't overcome. But Zechariah predicts that that mountain will become like a plain. And he said that that Zerubbabel himself would bring forward the top stone, the capstone of this new temple. And among shouts of grace, grace to it. So this overwhelming feeling that they had about their temple was going to dissolve, and the temple was going to be completed. And in this context of predicting the completion of the temple, Zechariah provides a theology lesson. Now, more than anything else, theology is what's needed in a situation like this, isn't it? Theos is the Greek word for God. Logia means study of. We have a lot of words with a L-O-G-Y ending. Anthropology, eschatology, hydrology, etymology, all meaning the study of the first half of the word. So theology quite simply means the study of God. His characteristics, his thought processes, his perspective, his truth. The Jews' problem here was that they were looking at their situation through their own perspective, their own eyes, which I think we're all prone to do. And when we do, it's very easy for us to get discouraged. It's easy for us to get mired down. But it was Zechariah's theology lesson here. Zechariah is pointing people to God's perspective that proved to be the impetus that was needed for the Jews to get back to work. And history tells us that indeed they did complete the temple in Zerubbabel's administration. Now, what I'd like for us to see is that not only was Zechariah's theology lesson timely for his day, but that his words provide tremendous affirmation and validation for those of us today who are in smaller churches. Much needed, I think, because at times we feel intimidated. At times we have feelings of inferiority. Sometimes we get discouraged, especially when we start playing the comparison game maybe with bigger churches, or if our church might perhaps be in the shadow of a mega church, or if we've attended conferences or read books or articles or blogs in which bigger churches are kind of front and center. So the crux of our encouragement, I think, can be found in two verses. First of all, verse 6. An often quoted verse, but I wonder how many of us know the context from which we are quoting. Zechariah reminds the people that regarding the temple, and today I think there rightly is application here for the church, it's not human might or power that is important, but whether the Spirit of God is at work. Every square foot of the old temple, the big temple, Solomon's temple, had exhibited human might and power. First Chronicles tells us that 153,600 men had worked on that temple for 7 years at who knows what cost. It ended up being a massive palatial temple. But Zechariah says, you know what? It's not human might or power that matters. It's whether God's Spirit is working inside, bringing life and health and vitality to the congregation. And you might recall that there was little evidence of God's Spirit at work in Solomon's temple, especially during its latter days. Is the work of God's Spirit proportionate to the size of the church? Can a smaller church be as spiritually vital as a larger church? We ask questions like these, don't we? Theology lesson number one: God doesn't dole out His Spirit in proportion to the size of the church. This truth has been reinforced time and again for me through my 30-plus years of rural ministry that has taken me to countless places all across the U.S. and Canada. Some time ago, I did some interim preaching for a congregation that was averaging probably between 50 and 75 people in a town of probably 500. I was soon impressed by this congregation's wealth. I was impressed by this congregation's warmth, their spontaneity, their enthusiastic worship, their laughter, their tears, their hugs, their eagerness to receive the Word of God. It was an exemplary church. Now, it wasn't the building that necessarily impressed me. It wasn't that they had a morning service that was flawlessly executed. What I found striking was the vibrancy and the health in that congregation. The Spirit of God was clearly evident in their midst. Because this church was a couple of hours from our home, and because my family has commitments in our church in Morton, they didn't go with me on those Sundays when I was preaching in this little church a couple hours away. And so after each visit, I would come back and I would sit down with Roxy and the kids and I'd tell them about what I'd experienced. And after hearing that for a few Sundays, soon I think curiosity got the best of them, and so they cleared their calendar on a Sunday, and they traveled with me. And thankfully, I kind of held my breath, but thankfully that church that morning was everything that I had described to my family. And I'll never forget as we were driving home that afternoon, my wife said to me, "I would enjoy being a part of this church as much as a church of a couple thousand." And those were not empty words, because remember, my wife grew up in a church of a couple of thousand. Now, I share this not to speak disparagingly about big churches. As I said earlier, I'm not an anti-big church guy, but rather to underscore Zechariah's words. Spiritual vitality is not proportionate to size. Theology lesson number two emerges a few verses later, verse 10. In a few words, Zechariah shares the good news that in God's eyes, the smaller temple, and again today I think there's rightly application for the church, the smaller temple, the smaller church, is not inferior. And actually, Zechariah takes this a step further. As he here is trying to lift Israel out of their doldrums so they'll get back to building the temple, he predicts, "Whoever has despised the day of small things, whoever might right now be moaning and groaning about the size of that footprint, that foundation that they are looking at, shall someday rejoice." Those of you who are thinking that small is inferior are going to have a change of mind. Your mind is going to change from sadness to joy. That's Zechariah's prediction. Now let's unpack this sentence in verse 10 just a bit. Day here in this verse refers not to a 24-hour day, but to a period of time. We might say we live in a day of economic prosperity, meaning that we live in a time when the economy is doing pretty well. Zechariah here is predicting that the Jews are about to enter a period of time, they're about to enter a season of ministry when small is going to be the norm. There's not going to be massive crowds in this temple that's going to be built. And very important, he says, that during this season of ministry, people are going to find joy. This new season of ministry, though much smaller, is going to be a time of joy. Most anyone who has been in ministry for some years will attest to the fact that sometimes we have seasons of time, don't we, when big things just don't seem to happen. Maybe it's because we're in a small place where it seems like big things don't happen in our small town. More likely, it's because of the dailiness of ministry. Added to the difficulty of living with the dailiness of ministry, we may read about or we may hear about other churches, maybe down the road a ways, where seemingly big things are happening, and we find ourselves discouraged because it doesn't seem like stuff like that is happening in the place that we're at. I think it's always good for us to reflect on that. I think it's always good for us to do our best to make sure that we're not doing something that might hinder the working of God in our midst. But often we simply need to realize that big things are the exception. That's why they get the publicity. If a teacher has an ordinary children's class, a good class, but really nothing exceptional, then that's probably not going to get written up in a magazine or on somebody's blog, is it? Normal day-in, day-out ministry simply doesn't get a lot of press. But isn't that where most of the ministry is, when you think about it? Zechariah encourages us to not despise periods of time when seemingly only small, ordinary things are happening in our church. To the contrary, he encourages us to look for joy in the midst of the small things. Zechariah is saying to these Jews that in this new season of ministry, when we're in a period of time where things are going to be much smaller, there's still going to be lots of joy. Joy can be found in the small. By the way, this period of time could last a long time. Zechariah here could very well be referring to a time that stretched on for more than 400 years. Some of you might be thinking, what a coincidence. That's exactly how long I've been teaching my class. Zechariah here encourages us to find joy in the small stuff of ministry. Joy in the ordinary. Joy in day-to-day ministry. Joy in places where perhaps we don't have massive crowds or where there's not always big things that are happening. I think it would be good for us to ponder, maybe even as we leave here tonight, what are the sources of joy in the ministry that we're a part of? What are the sources of joy that we get from our church? Tomorrow we're going to talk about an off-the-beaten-path, small, unassuming church that was a huge source of joy to the Apostle Paul. I would venture to say that many of us in our respective ministries can probably count the major excitements in our ministries maybe on just our fingers. But think about this, if you would. It is ordinary, daily ministry, collectively over time, that is likely to make the bigger difference in people's lives. Very few people, when you think about it, receive lasting impact from one big, exciting ministry event. Now, that event might give us a quick charge. It might be the talk of our town for a few days. Maybe people are buzzing about it in the community. But chances are the excitement will soon fizzle and life will be back to the daily mundane. Think about how you have been most impacted in your life. Has it been through an exciting ministry event? Or has it been through the day in, day out, faithful ministry of people in your church? Years ago, a Scottish pastor of a small village church died. This pastor was known and loved for the way that he continually encouraged people in his church and community. When he died, someone noted, and I quote, "There is no one left to appreciate the triumphs of ordinary folks." Are we encouraging each other in the daily things that folks are doing in our smaller churches? Are we finding joy in those things? Are we helping others to find joy in the ministries that they are a part of? Now, not only does this text encourage us not to despise the day of small things, but it also encourages us to not despise small things. Throughout history, God has delighted in using a number of small things. Think David and Goliath as just one very simple example. What's the small thing that is front and center in this context. It's the anticipated smaller temple which will soon be constructed. The Hebrew word that's translated small here referred not only to size, but to what many considered insignificant, a description of how I think many folks were thinking of, or what they were thinking about their new temple, and quite frankly, a description of what I think many folks today think about smaller churches. And yet our text says that these are not to be despised. The Hebrew word despise means to hold as insignificant, to belittle, to regard as unimportant. Merrill Unger says that this verse challenges one who would look down upon something small in which God is glorified. Do you suppose that instead of finding joy, we are prone to despise small things? Out of curiosity, I used the thesaurus in my computer to find suggested synonyms for big and small. Synonyms for big: great, grand, tall, towering, major, considerable, vital, important, vast, lofty, lavish, substantial, generous, ample, mighty, full-grown, mature. Synonyms for small. Get ready. Runt, shrimp, piddling, dinky, one horse, pint size, undersized, limited, insignificant, scrawny, irrelevant, meaningless, pointless, stingy, negligible, trifling, petty, trivial, minor, second-rate, meager, shallow, narrow-minded, unimportant, puny. Are we prone to despise small things? The good news that I bring this evening is that God doesn't. In the eyes of God, the post-captivity temple was no small temple, and so it is today. The words of renowned theologian and apologist Francis Schaeffer, I think, captures God's perspective very well. He said, "In God's sight, there are no little people and no little places." Warren Wiersbe used to say, "In God's eyes, there are no little churches." And then he would go on to say, "And no big preachers." I think that would maybe be another sermon. God doesn't look down on churches because they're small. And Zechariah says that we shouldn't either. It's not complicated. Big is not always better. As I said, tomorrow we're going to look at a small church in a small town that was a source of incredible joy to the Apostle Paul. This evening, I'd like for us to close by considering how we might despise small things. I've identified ways that I know that I am prone to do so, and perhaps some of you can identify with me. First of all, we might despise small things when we don't prepare for a smaller number as much as we would for a larger number. Probably all of us have been there, haven't we, if we're honest? Maybe we slack off on preparation, maybe for preparation for a children's class, maybe worship preparation, maybe preparation for a Bible study. Those of you who are pastors, maybe sermon preparation. If we know that there are fewer that are going to show up at any given time, it's easy to kind of say, "Well, I'm just not going to quite put in the effort that I normally would." Or if we were to look at it from the flip side, if we knew that there were going to be 100 more people attending next week than this week, would we do a better job of preparation? I think there's a distasteful tendency in many of us, and I have to confess that I see this in myself at times, that we work harder if we know that there's going to be more people there. Second, we might despise small things by jumping to conclusions based upon size alone. We might look at a large church, and we might just assume that they have a better worship service or a better ministry to children or youth. But think about it. Is bigger always better? Would you rather live in a mansion with an abusive spouse or a simple farmhouse with a spouse that loves you very deeply? We need to avoid jumping to conclusions based on size alone, like the people in Zechariah's day did. If we had time, I would share lots of information with you about how smaller youth groups tend to have greater long-term impact than larger youth groups, how smaller churches produce vocational Christian workers at a much greater rate than bigger churches, how youth in smaller churches are not as likely to leave the church when they leave their teenage years and enter their young adult years, how discipleship is often more effective in a context of social intimacy. On and on it goes. We need to avoid jumping to conclusions based upon size alone. Third, we might despise small things when we assume that limited resources like people, finances, and buildings translate into inferior ministry. I think the best example of this is probably Gideon in the Old Testament. What did Gideon do? He tried to muster up as big an army as he could, and what did God tell him? He says, "You got too many men." God's work doesn't get done just because we manage to scrape together all the workers that we think that we need. That's operating under the might and power philosophy, which Zechariah discredits. We might assume that if we have limited money, then that limits what God can do. Sometimes being small means that we don't have all the bells and whistles of bigger churches. Maybe we don't have the building that bigger churches have. I think a good question to ask ourselves is, what is God incapable of doing because of our limited resources? How does that tie God's hands? And again, I think the story of Gideon helps get our thinking on track. He not only tried to amass a large army, but he also tried to amass a large cache of weapons. And what did God say? He said, "Put away your weapons. We're going to win this battle with trumpets, pitchers, and torches." Kind of ridiculous when you think about it, isn't it? Can we have a good children's ministry if our resources are the equivalent of trumpets, pitchers, and torches? I was struck by a video that I saw some time ago of a children's ministry, a bunch of kids playing on a foreign street, a street in a foreign city. And every few minutes, they had to clear the street. They're playing games, and they had to clear the street so that cars could go through, and then they would quickly get back on the street and run another game or two, and then they had to clear the street again. This is all part of a children's ministry that was in this location. And it kind of begs the question, just exactly how much facility do we need in order to have an effective children's ministry? Throughout history, God has often delighted in turning the tables upside down by doing big things with few resources. As the song written some time ago said, little is much when God is in it. Now, I probably need to hasten to say that the assumption here is not that laziness or stinginess is the issue. If we're short-staffed because of unwilling workers, or if we have a church facility that is inadequate because we're not giving as we're capable, then I think that's another problem. But if we're doing what we can and we still end up short, then God is more than able to make up the difference. And then fourth, we might despise small things when we assume that small size translates into small results. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21, we find David taking a census of all the people, or all the men, before deciding that he was going to lead them into battle, even though God had specifically told him, "I want you to go into battle." One of the severest disciplines of God resulted, leaving 70,000 of David's army dead. David relied too much on human might and power and not enough on God. David was reminded in that context that God can multiply resources 100 times over. And Christ proved this, didn't he, during the feeding of the 5,000? If we extrapolate that 100 times over, we could conclude that a church of 50 could accomplish what you would think that it would normally take a church of 5,000 to do. God can take a well-placed offering, and he could use it to win thousands to himself. The next world changer might be attending somebody's kids' ministry that's represented here tonight. This happened, didn't it, with Philip the evangelist? When God called him out of a big city ministry, his church was growing and vibrant in the city, and what did God say? He said, "I want you to go to this lonely rural outpost," and he had a congregation of one. But that person was from Ethiopia. And years later, when missionaries arrived in Ethiopia, they found widespread Christianity all through the country, reportedly because of Philip's ministry to just one person in a lonely rural outpost. Wouldn't it be something if one person in your church would someday be used of God to reach an entire nation? A quote that I think captures the gist of Zechariah chapter 4, kind of in a, I don't know, maybe a humorous way, or not sure how to say it, but anyway, let me just give you the quote. Here's Zechariah 4 in a nutshell. "If you ever think that you're too small to be effective, you've never been in bed with a mosquito." Every church, regardless of size, has limitless potential because it can draw from infinite resources. Tom Constable, in his commentary on Zechariah, says, "Never despise small things, for God is glorified in small things, and he uses them to accomplish great things." Do not despise small things. Do not assume that bigger is better. Don't moan and groan about small size. Rather, Zechariah says, find joy. There is so much good in small churches. Look for the good. I think that's the message of our text tonight. Evidently, King David, who earlier had taken that census, learned his lesson, because sometime later, he wrote in Psalm chapter 20, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." You know, we get caught up in the we're too small syndrome. The real issue might be theology, not the size. The real issue might be theology. When we find ourselves asking nagging questions about our small churches, we need to remind ourselves of God's perspective. In my favorite Peanuts cartoon, Lucy and Linus, they're looking out the window at a steady downpour. "Boy," says Lucy, "look at it rain. What if it floods the whole world?" And Linus replies, "It'll never do that. because in the 9th chapter of Genesis, God promised that that would never happen again, and the sign of the promise is the rainbow. To which Lucy replies, "You've taken a great load off of my mind." And Linus replies, "Sound theology has a way of doing that." Hopefully, sound theology will encourage us to press on. That's what my hope is for all of you tonight. Hopefully, sound theology will encourage us to press on. Hopefully, sound theology will lead us to the settled conviction that in God's sight, there are no little people and no little places. Can I pray? Is that okay? Let's pray. Father, I don't know these dear people, but I know that you know them. I know that you know their ministry circumstance, their context, the things that they're doing for you. And I just have to assume if they're just like other human beings, that there are probably times when they get discouraged because just the dailiness of ministry. I pray that you would infuse all of us here tonight with fresh encouragement, with your perspective on the ministries that God, that you have entrusted to us. Help us, Lord, to see our place of ministry. Help us to see our church as you do. And help us to not trust in human might or power, but to trust in your Spirit working among us. We pray these things in the name of Christ. Amen.